From ABC News, this is a special year-end edition of Perspective, the year's biggest stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the attacks of October 7th and the lives lost since.
World leaders, I don't know how they can sleep at night, quite frankly. I do not understand it. We've been saying the same thing over and over again. It seems that our words are just falling on deaf ears.
Auto workers, truck drivers, writers, and actors, the long, hot labor summer that forced inequality into the spotlight.
They're united in that sense, which is that one of the things that needs to be fixed in the country is the balance between management and investors and workers.
And the missing submersible that captured the attention of the world.
You know, when you're outside the box, it's really hard to tell how far outside the box you really are. And we were pretty far out there.
All ahead on this special year-end edition of Perspective. On this final weekend of 2023, we're bringing you a collection of some of the year's biggest stories, from labor strikes to presidential indictments to that missing submersible. This show is a listen back. But just a heads up, all of these stories have already aired, so you may hear conversations alluding to this week, even though they may have happened months ago. Let's begin in the Middle East on October 7th with a terror attack from inside Gaza that shook Israel to its core. ABC's James Longman met a young survivor of that day.
This was a typical day in Rotem Matthias's family. His parents, Deborah and Shlomi, laughing and singing along with friends and family. But family bliss erupted into sheer terror when Hamas militants broke into their family's kibbutz, spraying gunfire through the windows. His mother's body fell on top of him.
The terrorists shot open the door. They threw a grenade or something. It exploded. The last thing my dad said is he lost his arm. And then my mom died on top of me.
He managed to send a simple WhatsApp to an extended family text chain writing, "Parents dead. Sorry."
I just stopped my breathing. I lowered it down as much as I possibly could. I didn't move. I was terrified. I didn't make any noise. And I prayed for any God. I didn't really care which God. I just prayed for a God that they won't find me.
ABC's James Longman in Israel. That week we also aired an interview with a young Palestinian woman subject to incessant bombing in Gaza. Her name is Noor Al-Saka.
Gaza's worst fears at the moment is the sun setting, because things start to get like really aggressive, and aggressive is an understatement, to be honest. Even the videos, like when I watch them later on, they do not showcase a bit of how horrific experiencing a building being bombed right across the street is. Like the house shakes, the windows crack, the doors slam. It gets so intense and it feels like the world is ending for a few minutes here and there. You cannot look at what happened in the past few days without looking at the past 75 years, without looking at least at the past month. And it's so hard to think about a future, about, I don't know, democracy, about any of that stuff when we're literally still under colonialism.
Noor Al-Saka in Gaza. ABC Chief National Correspondent Matt Gutman has been covering the Middle East for more than 20 years. The week of October 7th, he visited some of the areas in Israel closest to Gaza, the town of Ashkelon just to the north, and the scene of that music festival just to the east. We talked to Matt from his car on the way back to Tel Aviv.
Describe for us, Matt, what you saw, what was left of the party that was going on.
There were hundreds of cars there. Many of them had been burned. Lots of them had rear windshields blown out. There were bullet holes in many of them, and the roads had been blocked. The little routes out had been blocked. Some of the porta potties were completely soaked with blood, and the bodies had already been taken out. But the Israeli military felt it was very important for the media to be able to see this.
With all of the refugees who will be left in Gaza after this, who takes care of all those refugees? Israel? The UN? The world?
That's a million-dollar question. But to go in there to fight this group that has been deeply entrenched, specifically in Gaza, really since 1987, the first intifada, is going to be unbelievably difficult. And then you don't know who is a fighter, who is not, who is involved politically. There's almost no way to know. It is a very scary thing to think about, this end game. It does not end well. And what we're seeing now, thousands of dead already on both sides, that is going to be just the tip of the iceberg if Israel actually commits to going in with hundreds of thousands of ground troops into Gaza. The humanitarian toll is going to be unprecedented in the Middle East, certainly in the past couple of generations. It's very, very scary to think about. And right now, Egypt has blocked its border. It's not allowing Palestinians to flee into Egypt. They have nowhere to go. They are locked in there as those bombs are falling, and many, many civilians have come in the line of fire.
ABC's Matt Gutman, our chief foreign correspondent. We really appreciate your work. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
In the nearly 3 months since October 7th, the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says more than 20,000 Palestinians have been killed in airstrikes and bombings, and nearly all of the territory's almost 2 million people have been displaced. As a part of our coverage in the fall, ABC's Lindsay Davis spoke with Faris Al-Jawad, a spokesman for the humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders.
This new acronym that has been created specifically due to this conflict, WCNSF, which stands for Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. How prevalent of an issue is that?
The vast majority of the patients that we see are indeed children. The other day, after the Jabalia camp was hit, we received many children in Al-Shifa Hospital, and one of our colleagues described to me the fact that most of these children arrived without any parents, without any family. They were screaming for their parents, screaming for their family. There was nobody there, so our team member had to stay with the children, obviously give them emergency medical care, but also stay with them thereafter because they're alone. The hospitals themselves are loaded with not only severely wounded patients in beds, on the ground, in the corridors, but of course thousands and thousands of people seeking shelter. So it's just carnage. There's no other way to describe it. There's nowhere for people to go. The idea to be able to evacuate these hospitals is just ludicrous. There's nowhere to go. And indeed, leaving the hospitals with patients, obviously, who are sick and ill and in dire shape would mean a death sentence. World leaders, I don't know how they can sleep at night, quite frankly. I do not understand it. We've been saying the same thing over and over again. It seems that our words are just falling on deaf ears. Sometimes it doesn't even seem worth doing these interviews to some degree because it seems like nobody's listening.
Faris Al-Jawad with ABC's Lindsay Davis. Coming up, another war and a question. Was there actually a turning point in Ukraine this year? That on this special year-end edition of Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to this special year-end edition of Perspective from ABC News. I'm Sherry Preston. Just a few weeks ago, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky came to Washington to ask for more funding for the war. His request came 6 months after the long-awaited counteroffensive had begun in Ukraine. And many, including our own chief foreign correspondent Ian Pano, believe this was a key turning point in the war. Before leaving for Kyiv in June to cover the fighting once again, Ian came to our studios in New York. Ian, billions, hundreds of billions have been spent on this war in Ukraine, and at some point it's going to have to wrap up, if for no other reason than money.
On one level, there are 38 billion reasons why this needs to start coming to some kind of conclusion, because that's the number of tax dollars, US tax dollars, that have been put into the military and humanitarian funding for Ukraine. Many other countries have also given large amounts of money, although none as much as the U.S.
I believe we'll have the funding necessary to support Ukraine as long as it takes. And I believe that we're going to that support will be real, even though there are you hear some voices today on Capitol Hill about whether or not we should continue.
Now, of course, this isn't just about Manjushri. This is about human lives being lost. It's about a country that's been invaded. It's about a war that has no justification. It's about alleged war crimes and all of those other things. However, where does it end? I think they have to show that they are capable of retaking some of the land that Russia has occupied. Because if they can't after this big push, then I think there will be very serious questions asked as to, well, how much longer do we carry on putting money into something if it's not having an impact on the ground?
The fact of the matter is, I asked people a picture, what would happen if we were not supporting Ukraine? Do we think Russia would stop in Kyiv? Do you think that's all there would be happening?
How would the Ukrainians feel about giving any sort of land to Russia at all?
Totally unacceptable. I remember having a conversation, actually, with two women who were in their 30s, both from Kyiv and highly qualified and educated. This is what they would say. We made a deal with Vladimir Putin back in 2015, the Minsk agreements. This was after Putin had taken Crimea and Donbass in the east of the country, and he didn't honor it. You can't negotiate again with someone like that who has clearly broken those promises. He will use the intervening period to rearm. This is what they will tell you, to rearm, and then he'll try and take the country again. In other words, there's no real end to this, as far as they're concerned, unless every square inch of Ukrainian territory is back in Ukrainian hands.
And really, what's more surprising in that the Ukrainians have done so well or that the Russians have done so poorly?
I think it's a brilliant question. I mean, and history will tell that the one could not have existed without the other. The Russian military showed itself to be a shadow of what we feared or what many people feared. Mm-hmm. You know, many people said it's the second most powerful army in the world. Well, clearly that wasn't true. It's a very Soviet command system. So some general gives an order and it just has to be followed all the way through, even if that order clearly makes no sense on the ground. Hmm. A lot of the equipment and strength they thought they had, they didn't, because there's been so much skimming. And people have literally been stuffing their pockets with cash instead of actually properly supporting the military. So when push came to shove and they needed it, it just wasn't there. Hmm. So I think the parlous state of the Russian military, the fact that Putin made no case for the war in the first place. I mean, we heard tales of soldiers who were wounded or imprisoned, and they had no idea they were even in Ukraine. When they're looking at it, they go, this village looks like my grandmother's village. It looks like my babushka's village. So I think for them, there's never been any heart in this, apart from the most elite soldiers. And for the Ukrainians, I saw a unity in Ukraine that I've never seen in any other conflict that I've ever covered. Like, not just soldiers, but every single person putting their shoulder right to the war effort. Everyone, even grandmothers. There was one grandmother famously in Kyiv who used to teach ballet. And when the war started, she started making Molotov cocktails, right? Petrol bombs. So everyone kind of put all of their might into the war effort.
ABC's Ian Pannell, our foreign correspondent, chief foreign correspondent. It's nice to see you in person.
Yeah, great to be here, Sherry.
Thanks. The 2024 presidential election is now less than a year away. The Republican frontrunner, in the polls at least, remains former President Donald Trump, who's facing at least four upcoming trials related to the last time he was in office, allegations related to his business dealings, election interference in Georgia, his actions on January 6th, and the discovery of numerous classified documents at his Mar-a-Lago residence. That's the case we talked about with ABC national correspondent Stephen Portnoy back in July. Stephen, this actually superseding indictment, there was a lot in there.
An alleged conspiracy to obstruct justice, Sherry, and this is a damning accusation leveled by the grand jury and the special prosecutor's office that former President Trump directed his maintenance man at Mar-a-Lago to get with his IT man to have security camera footage deleted. That footage would have showed his body man, Walt Nauta, working with the maintenance man, Carlos de Oliveira, to move dozens of boxes to avoid his attorney, Trump's attorney, having eyes on those boxes so that he could then certify to the Justice Department that all the classified material had already been removed from Mar-a-Lago. This accusation takes the specter of obstruction of justice to a whole new level, and a dramatic one, because inside this 60-page superseding indictment, you see a narrative in which the maintenance man takes the IT man into a closet and says, just between you and me, the boss, wants it done.
This reads like a movie. It reads exactly like a movie. Why didn't we know about this earlier in the case?
When the first indictment in the classified documents case was handed up in early June, there was a reference to Trump Employee 2. Not named, but the suggestion was that Trump Employee 2 worked with Walt Nauta, Trump's body man, to move these document boxes around. We spoke with a legal analyst this week who suggested that perhaps prosecutors had been working with Trump Employee 2, unnamed in the indictment, to see if he might be cooperative. But Trump Employee 2, who we now know as Carlos de Oliveira, the maintenance man, not only has not cooperated, he's also charged in this indictment with lying to the FBI when the FBI asked him in early 2022 whether he had any role in moving these boxes around. He said simply no. And now the prosecutors have video evidence of him moving it around, text messages which indicate that he was engaged in the process of moving things around, and also the testimony, it seems, of the IT man who will say, we believe in court, that the former president directed the maintenance man to tell the IT man that the boss wants the video footage deleted.
And all this happening in a week that we are also expecting something to happen in the January 6th investigation, again being run by special counsel Jack Smith.
On Thursday, the same day that the special prosecutor's office offered that superseding indictment in the classified documents case, in Washington, D.C., Jack Smith was meeting with the former president's attorneys. And as far as we know, there was no indication given to the Trump attorneys that the superseding indictment was coming, that more charges would be coming. And this specter of charges in the January 6th case still hang over the former president. That will continue into the weekend.
So when the president's lawyers met with him on Thursday, they didn't have any inkling that this was coming later in the day, and all of this happening in the same week that we had a lot of action in the Hunter Biden case. And you were following that as well.
This all played out in a federal courtroom in Wilmington, just as dramatic as what we've been discussing so far with respect to former President
Trump. Stunning developments after a five-year investigation and months of behind-the-scenes negotiations. They came up with a deal that the judge really pretty quickly found ambiguities in.
Lawyers for Hunter Biden have been saying for weeks publicly that they expected that the plea agreement that their client Hunter Biden had entered with the U.S. attorney in Delaware would be the end of a years-long investigation by the Justice Department into the president's son and his business dealings. What they identified was two instances in 2017 and 2018 where he didn't pay his federal income taxes, and there was the fact that he had purchased a handgun at a time that he was an admitted drug user, which is against the law. That's a felony. And so the agreement was reached between the Justice Department and Hunter Biden that he would plead guilty to two tax-related misdemeanors. And in exchange, the prosecutors would divert or otherwise not bring the felony gun charge. Well, when all this started playing out in federal court in Wilmington, Delaware on Wednesday, the judge presiding over the case, Mary Ellen Noreika, raised a number of substantial questions about the way this document was constructed, and in particular, whether the plea agreement would absolve Hunter Biden of any ongoing liability with respect to any other crimes he might have committed in this period of time from 2017 to, let's say, 2020. And when the prosecutors said in open court that it was not their understanding that they were granting any kind of blanket immunity to Hunter Biden, the Biden defense attorneys were on their heels. And they said, whoa, that was not our understanding. This agreement that we thought we had is now null and void. But what was most interesting to me and to many other observers was to hear the judge specifically ask a question about the Foreign Agents Registration Act, or FARA. Congressional Republicans have been alleging for some time now that Hunter Biden may have run afoul of the FARA Act, which requires those people who are being paid to do the bidding of foreign entities to register those activities with the Justice Department. Hunter Biden never did, as he was taking millions of dollars from Chinese and Ukrainian business entities. And congressional Republicans suggest that maybe Hunter Biden should be brought up on those charges. So when the judge asked about that and the prosecution said in open court that it's possible such charges could come, that was news to Hunter Biden's defense team, and that further derailed any kind of agreement they thought they had.
Okay, and so glad to have you back. Stephen Portnoy, our new national correspondent based in Washington here at ABC News. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks, Sherry.
Coming up, abortion on the ballot in 2023, what the Dobbs decision meant in local elections, plus the end of a long, hot labor summer, what this year's strikes meant for workers' rights on this special year-end edition of Perspective after this.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is a special year-end edition of Perspective, this year's biggest stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the missing submersible and the week it captured our attention. But first, it's been more than a year since the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision handing the issue of women's reproductive rights back to the states. It will certainly be an issue in the big election of 2024, but it was in 2023 elections as well. ABC News political director Rick Klein talked about that with us back in June.
Some big numbers coming in from three key states, Ohio and Kentucky and Virginia.
And Sherry, it was a different story in each of them, but the same kind of result. In all three states, you had voters side for abortion rights. In Ohio, directly so, because the question was about amending the state constitution to enshrine that as part of the state constitution, and that was overwhelmingly yes.
I was a daughter of a very young mother, so I have my own views on that because I'm glad I'm here, but I also believe that everyone has a right to their own opinions.
So. Choice, man. The government should not control a woman's body.
In Virginia, control of the legislature was at stake. The Republican governor there has said if we get a majority of Republicans, we're going to get a 15-week abortion ban with some exceptions. Democrats ended up getting control of both chambers. And in Kentucky, a very red state, you had the Democratic governor reelected, and he has been railing against the state's abortion ban, made that a critical part of his campaign.
It was a victory that sends a loud, clear message. A message that candidates should run for something and not against someone.
So we've seen it now in state after state, red, blue, purple, doesn't really matter. Voters are saying they want some kind of protections for abortion rights, and they seem to be reacting that way when they have a chance to vote on an issue or a candidate.
You know, when it wasn't on the ballot, either directly or indirectly, Republicans did okay.
Yeah, I mean, Mississippi is the classic case. The Republican governor there, despite some scandals, was reelected against a Democrat who actually opposes abortion rights and did not make abortion a critical part of his race. So look, the landscape of this country right now, with high inflation, with two wars, with the general unease and dissatisfaction, very much would seem to favor the party that's not in power right now, the Republican Party. But when it gets down to actually voting on issues, the Democrats continue to have a hold on voters. And they won this past week, not because of Joe Biden, but maybe in spite of Joe Biden. And I think that tells us some important lessons for the year ahead.
Yeah, when you do look ahead and you look at Joe Biden, there's a lot of people who are worried.
And starting with the obvious points, he's quite obviously not getting younger. And people have concerns about his age and his ability to do the job, and inflation and the economy. People are laying that at Joe Biden's feet. And there's a sense in Democratic circles that they're walking into this primary season, with the inevitable nominee that they know is flawed and they know is a question mark. And maybe the best thing they have going for them in terms of the argument for Biden is that Donald Trump is looking like the Republican nominee. But it's still not a certain bet. There's polls out that show that Trump could be competitive, if not actually beat Joe Biden in some critical battleground states.
We will finish the job that we started so brilliantly 7 years ago. We never had a country like we had just 3 years ago.
And of course, it's a bigger risk if Trump isn't the nominee, because those same polls are showing people like Nikki Haley, Ron DeSantis, even more clear favorites in a matchup against Biden.
Those are some of the names of people who were on stage at the most recent Republican debate. Pretty serious barbs were traded back and forth that night. But what was your overall take on the debate that happened this week?
First, it was shocking to me to see how little Trump played. I mean, the reality of this race, Donald Trump's winning by 30, 40 points in the polls, and he was barely talked about. Only in glancing. And basically the critique of him was he spent too much money as president, or he's changed his position on Ukraine. It wasn't about January 6th. It wasn't about all of the various legal cases. Other than Chris Christie, no one's making that case. I was also struck by how much Vivek Ramaswamy just came in like a heat-seeking missile for his rivals, and the very personal attacks on Nikki Haley.
In the last debate, she made fun of me for actually joining TikTok while her own daughter was actually using the app for a long time. So you might want to take care of your family first.
Leave my daughter out of your voice.
Haley coming back and saying you're just a scum.
Here's the truth.
You're just
the easy
scum.
Answer.
I mean, that to me, you know, he was sort of a stand-in for Donald Trump in that sense, that to come in and do that. I feel like this is often going to be described as, and probably is, a race for second place. Not to say that the person on that stage couldn't actually become the nominee, but they're going to become maybe the Trump alternative. I'm kind of, in my mind, I'm thinking about this like March Madness brackets, where there's like one side that's basically filled out already in Trump's name. You can write it down in ink all the way to the finals. The other side has some interesting stuff going on to see who the one against Trump is. And I think to that end, Nikki Haley did herself a lot of good. These debates have boosted her profile. I mean, Chris Christie's been strong too, but I think he's got some limits as to where he can go. Ron DeSantis didn't have a bad debate.
If someone in the drug cartels is sneaking fentanyl across the border when I'm president, that's going to be the last thing they do. We're going to shoot him stone cold dead.
But it's not clear that he's able to turn this around. And Tim Scott just, he barely made this last debate. And other than learning or getting the first pictures of him and his girlfriend, there weren't a lot of headlines about him out of this one.
ABC's Rick Klein, our political director here. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Sherry.
They dubbed it the long, hot labor summer. We watched as Hollywood came to a halt, as UPS drivers nearly stopped delivering packages, and as healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente said enough to staffing shortages and pay disparity. One of the biggest strikes nationwide, however, involved the auto workers.
We are the union!
150,000 members of the UAW took part in targeted picketing over the summer and fall, and in the end, reached deals with Ford, Stellantis, which used to be Chrysler, and finally, GM. We talked with ABC senior national correspondent Terry Moran once that agreement was inked in November.
This is, by any measure, a big win for workers and a vindication of the strategy that was pursued by the United Auto Workers' relatively new president, Sean Fain, who came in promising to get tough, and he did. They got a 25% pay increase over 4 years. They were asking for 40%. 25% is pretty big as well. They got more paid time off, including paid family leave, 2 weeks of paid family leave. That's a first. They got major gains on pensions in this contract. By any measure, this is going to be major improvement in pay and benefits and power for workers.
This year has really been pivotal for American workers.
It really has. It's been a year of change, and change for the better for a lot of workers. That said, there's no question that all of the management still answers to investors, you know, big investors, big institutional investors, who have time and time again on every quarterly earnings call saying, what are you doing providing all those benefits to workers? What are you doing with those pay raises? We want the returns on our investments. You talk to CEOs of big companies, and they'll tell you they dread those quarterly earnings calls, because while they may be the boss in name, at the end of the day, they'll lose their job if the investors aren't happy with what they do.
I'd like to get your thoughts on the greater labor movement this whole summer and fall. I mean, whether it's Kaiser Permanente, the writers, the actors now, people are kind of taking notice, going, okay, look, this income inequality is a big deal to a lot of these workers. And that's what's at the heart of a lot of this, saying we have been hit hard by inflation, by the cost of living, and we're feeling it, and we want you to know that. Is that the sense that you've gotten as well?
Absolutely. And Sherry, for the first time in decades, workers have the upper hand. They don't want to lose workers, and they're desperate. They can't really find them in many instances. And so that gives power to the workers who, as you say, have been feeling, no question about it. It's one of the reasons we have a real populist energy in this country. You know, watching as a few zip codes, it seems, got very, very wealthy, and the rest of America kind of stagnated or even went down. They're united in that sense, which is that one of the things that needs to be fixed in the country is the balance between management and investors and workers. And Sean Fain himself said that this deal should be, as he said, put it, a call to action to organize and fight for a better life.
Well, ABC's Terry Moran, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I love your insight on everything. Thank you so much.
It's a story that matters to a lot of people. I appreciate it.
Really thanks, does. Thanks, Terry.
Coming up, the submersible that mesmerized the world and the end of some of our favorite television shows in 2023. On this special year-end edition of Perspective after this. You're listening to a special year-end edition of Perspective from ABC News. I'm Sherry Preston.
All week long, we watched and we waited for word of the missing submersible in the North Atlantic. Five people on board the Titan, three adventurers, a deep sea expert with vast knowledge of the wreck of the Titanic, and the CEO of OceanGate, the company that owned the vessel, Stockton Rush, who told the BBC this.
You know, when you're outside the box, it's really hard to tell how far outside the box you really are. And we were pretty far out there. If you're not breaking things, you're not innovating. If you're operating within a known environment, as most submersible manufacturers do, they don't break things. To me, the more stuff you've broken, the more innovative you've been.
We learned that the five on board were not sitting in the vessel on the ocean floor or bobbing on the surface as oxygen slowly ran out. They were killed instantly in a catastrophic implosion approximately an hour and a half into their journey. And now the question, so many of them, about the craft and how OceanGate had designed it. Among those with concerns, Titanic director James Cameron, who has been to the wreckage site dozens of times and has built his own submersible. He told ABC News,
if I had to put money down on what the finding will be, the Achilles heel of the sub was the composite cylinder that was the main hull that the people were inside. There were two titanium end caps on each end. They are relatively intact on the seafloor, but that carbon fiber composite cylinder is now in very small pieces and it's all rammed into one of the hemispheres. This was trying to apply aviation thinking to a deep submergence engineering problem. And we all said that it was a flawed idea and they didn't go through certification. So it wasn't sort of peer-reviewed by other engineering entities, you know, like any of these, what they call classing bureaus that do certification for vessels and submersibles and things like that.
ABC Transportation reporter Sam Sweeney joins us now. So what was the problem?
The best way to understand it is that when you have a material that isn't proven, like carbon fiber, we don't know how it reacts to pressurization and then depressurization, going up and down on the surface, how that wears on the material. Think about a balloon that you would have at a birthday party. If you blew that balloon up and then you deflated it and you did that on repeat, eventually the nylon is going to become weak and it's going to pop. Well, that's what appears to have happened with this submersible vehicle. And in 2018, a former employee told the company, I think we need to be doing more inspections using different techniques because I don't believe that this carbon fiber can hold up or withstand these conditions that we're going to put it through.
It wasn't certified because it was an experimental craft, which all those on board knew, and they signed waivers saying that they knew that. Right, Sam?
Look, this was truly experimental. And the question is, did these people really know the concerns and the dangers that they faced? And I think that that's going to be looked at. These people, you know, some have said that they were almost like guinea pigs testing this vehicle out.
All of this raises issues about so-called adventure tourism. Who foots the bill when something like this goes wrong?
That's a great question. And a lot of people are really upset about this. Well, the initial reports from the Coast Guard are that they foot the bill and they don't submit or request payment from people who are rescued because they believe that in the future it could turn people off to asking for help when they're in dire situations out at sea. And they want people to be comfortable reaching out to them.
ABC Transportation reporter Sam Sweeney. Finally, as we wrap up our year-end show, this wasn't really one of the biggest stories of the year, but it was one we thought was fitting. During the pandemic, a lot of us got very invested in television shows. Over the past few years, we came to truly love the characters and the stories in shows like Barry, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Ted Lasso, and Succession. Well, this year, all of those shows came to an end in the same week. We sat down to discuss that with ABC News entertainment correspondent Jason Nathanson in June.
It's one of those things where it's a product of the way we watch television and the way things have changed in the way we watch television. These were all four, or in the case of Maisel, five season series on broadcast. The critically acclaimed series, the series that we all loved that ran forever, like think Big Bang Theory, Seinfeld, right? Friends, which ran for I think 9 or 10 seasons. Those shows that people loved, the networks never wanted them to go off the air. As expensive as they got, they were bringing in eyeballs and people loved them. Now it's much more about quality over quantity. And these creators have a lot more room to say, hey, look, I only want to do 3 seasons of Ted Lasso and I'm out.
Bit of news from the other side of the Atlantic. AFC Richmond announced the hiring of their new manager, American football coach Ted Lasso.
You're an American who's now in charge of a football club despite possessing very little knowledge of the game.
Oh.
I know that AFC Richmond is going to give you everything they got, win or lose.
Or tie.
Right, y'all do ties here.
That was the original plan for Ted Lasso, right? Jason Sudeikis and Brendan Hunt, creators of the show, went in and said, we have this idea for a 3-season arc that we want to do, and that's it. Now, what they keep saying over and over is they never counted on the success of the show. They didn't know how wildly popular it would be and that maybe people would be upset with it ending after 3 seasons, and maybe Apple wanted to keep it going after 3 seasons. That's a decision now they're going to try to make, but a lot of these shows, they want to be in and out.
What do you think about these shows and what makes them so special? I mean, is it the writing? Is it the story arc? You mentioned just 3 and done. Some of them have gone on a lot more than that. Or is it the characters and the acting that we've seen? It's just sort of you mentioned Big Bang Theory and you mentioned Seinfeld, great comedies that we love. But these are like a step up when it comes to acting, especially if I could say Succession, which I think has been phenomenal.
It's a combination of all of them. If you look at Ted Lasso specifically, that was a show that came at the perfect time during the pandemic. When everything was doom and gloom, life just didn't feel very bright and shiny and happy. And here comes this show that was just so much about positivity and inspiration. And in addition to also being good. And then you look at a show like Succession.
Everything I've done in my life, I've done for my children. I know I've made mistakes. But I've always tried to do the best by them because I love them.
That first season, most people were not watching that show. And by season 2, it really hit its stride. And I tried to tell people, as many people as possible, it's a comedy. And once you wrap your head around the fact that it's a comedy and you start to, oh, we're supposed to laugh at these people. Then you start to go, okay, now I get it. It's satire.
However, Jason, I will say, in the end, I'm going to challenge you on that and say that it turned tragic. You know, that was a big debate over Succession. Is it a comedy or is it a tragedy? And they clearly said at the end, this was a tragedy, you know, with comedy thrown in. But other people would say it was a dark comedy with some tragedy thrown in. But the end of that show was so deep and so searing that to me, it couldn't be anything but a tragedy.
And that's one of the great things about television right now is the fact that these lines, they're blurred and mixed up and all mixed together and all in one show. You look at a show like Barry.
These people I take out, they're bad people. The money's good. It's a job.
Barry is supposed to be a straight up comedy from Bill Hader from Saturday Night Live. He does the voices and impressions. And that's a really dark show. All about PTSD that got darker and darker and darker. So if you were watching a show that you were laughing at before, you weren't laughing by the end of Barry.
How much do you think of this has to do with the way we watch television? I still remember when House of Cards came out and they dumped it all at once. And everybody watched it and got a lot of buzz. And then we all started realizing, well, gosh, maybe it's not as much fun to watch these shows all at once when nobody else is watching them with me. And we're back to the way we used to do it when I was a kid. And when you go talk to people, you say, don't talk to me. I can't hear you. Please do not. Don't tell me what happened at the end of Succession. I don't want to know the final episode of Ted Lasso. We can all talk to each other about TV.
I personally like that model better, but it depends on the service. You know, Netflix is still dropping everything all at once. That's their model, and it's okay for them. The shows we're mostly talking about right now, those are all weekly dropping shows. And it gives us a chance to talk about it every week, and that gets more listeners, more eyeballs on the actual show itself.
Jason Nathanson, thank you so much. Appreciate talking to you about the end of these great series and the finales, and we're going to miss these shows. Thanks, Jason.
Sure thing. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to this special year-end edition of Perspective. This edition was produced by ABC's Mauro Milwaukee. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.